to your weekly Pulse Sunday. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, and of course joined by our great contributors, Mr. George Grombacher, coming to us live from Scottsdale, Arizona, and also from New York City, it's Ms. Natalie Walters coming to us from The Motley Fool. She's the tech reporter over there, and she's going to be filling us in. Guys, how are you this week?
Doing great.
Have a good week?
Doing great.
Have a good weekend?
You know what? If I were to look into the future, I would report back and say, yeah, my weekend was totally awesome. So,
well, I'm glad to hear that. Glad to hear that. So it's been a busy week, and I know we're going to jump right into it in a few minutes. But before we do, you know, I was just looking online. One of the periodicals that I often go to is Pensions and Investments Magazine, and they're co-sponsoring this year's Excellence and Innovation Awards for defined contribution plans with the Defined Contribution Institutional Investment Association. So if listeners are not aware, they can go to the P&I website. We'll list that on the website, on the podcast description, and they can go and submit their favorite defined contribution plan if they're innovative. I think that's pretty neat. I mean, we definitely
That's looking for people to submit a plan sponsor that's doing a great job with their actual plan.
Absolutely, you know, George, you're a great translator because I'm like the bumbling fool on this. But yeah, I mean, you're absolutely correct. So if there's a plan sponsor, an employer, a government, tax exempt entity, a corporation, someone who is doing something right, it doesn't matter how big, how small.
Got it.
You know, what are you doing that you've done? You know, measurable improvements, and I think we need more of this. We need to hear about more innovation.
More success stories are always good, and this is kind of cool because my wife is in human resources. She runs human resources for a company, and she said, "I got to learn more about the Motley Fool. They have this amazing culture over there." So I don't know if she's way off base, Natalie, or if she's right on the money. But perhaps you should nominate your own company.
I'd have to agree with her, but I might be a little bit biased there.
Yeah.
I'm not the best reporter for that particular story.
Fair enough.
Well, I think so. You know, listeners can certainly are encouraged to. You know, we're not going to endorse anyone, obviously, but they're encouraged to certainly think about this. Case studies, I always believe, and I think it's the same with you, George. Really, go a long way rather than just people bloviating about what could be done. Hey, what has happened? And what are the measurable results? And I think that would be a long way to helping people plan and save and build a better retirement plan for their participants.
No doubt. I think that's great.
So, well, guys, let's get started. George, I saw that you did several interviews this week on the Money Savage podcast. Do you want to fill the audience in and also maybe your top concepts for the week, top things that you're thinking about when you're talking to clients as an advisor?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And we did have some great guests. I think that one of the big takeaways was we had Bo Henderson on from from Rich Life Advisors, talking about being a good steward of your finances. And then I also saw somewhere that the average American spends $140 a day. That comes out to be about $51,000 a year. And getting back to what you were talking about percentages, and oftentimes those really don't resonate with us. It's more about the actual story. And I'm just now, this week, I took on a new client, and I'm getting them onboarded. And I really think that you can see the excitement that people demonstrate when they know that they're going to have an opportunity to actually sit down and talk to a real person about their retirement and about their retirement plan. So I think that all these technological advances are incredible and amazing, but I also know firsthand that people want to be able to have an honest and frank conversation about their financial situation. So that's really what's on my mind, is being a good steward of your finances, understanding what's coming in, but more importantly, understanding what's going out and how much am I actually spending and the value of talking to actual people.
I love that. Great topics this week. Natalie, let's turn our attention to the wonderful world of technology. I know you're covering a couple items, not the least of which is this Amazon Echo conversation that we talked a little bit about last week. What's the new latest on that?
Yeah, so I just wanted to give a quick update on that since we've been talking about that story off and on. If you missed it, the story was that there was a Seattle area family whose conversation was recorded on an Echo and actually sent to somebody on their contact list. And that person who received the recording contacted the family and told them, you should unplug your device because I just got sent a conversation from you guys. And so they did. And then they reported it to the media to let other users know what could happen. And so Amazon responded this week, and it was kind of a PR response where they said, you know, we're taking privacy seriously. We're investigating this. And after the investigation, they recently said they're going to take steps to prevent this from ever happening again, even though it was a rare occurrence. So I guess that's a good update to get, but it's interesting because it's coming after the backlash. And I even saw a report that said a number of people were throwing out their Echo devices after the story came out because they were getting nervous about what could potentially be recorded or sent to somebody they know or maybe somebody they don't know. So it's just interesting to see the difference in companies' first response to the situation and then maybe after the public outcry. And I don't know what you guys think about that, if you guys are going to unplug your devices now or not.
I'm actually sitting in front of like 8 devices. I've got my laptop, which is how I'm connected, and then I've got my iPad and my iPhone and my headphone. You know, I think this is going to be an ongoing conversation. I think you do point out something interesting, and in that the PR, quote unquote PR response, is how people respond to this. If you know, we've talked about the Facebook issue and the Cambridge Analytica, and it took them a little bit of time to respond. Mm-hmm. And this was maybe a little bit more, more responsive in terms, maybe they learned a little bit of a lesson, but I think these issues, these privacy issues stick with us. And I think going back to what George said from the retirement point of view, you know, we're seeing the adoption of technology, but really, you know, when you're talking about people's dollars, and of course the Amazon Echo, you can buy things and whatnot. I mean, you really want to be contain that information. George, what's your thought on this?
Yes. I think that anytime you're trying to make up your mind about an important issue, there's no reason to even consider the actual company, or if we were talking about politics, the political party. Let's just measure something based on its merits. And is privacy important? I don't care if it's Amazon or XYZ. The answer is yes. And do I want to be recorded mm-hmm. without my knowledge? No, I do not. So that's, right. I guess, the fundamental answer. We talked a little bit about it last week, and I think I was a little bit wishy-washy about it. But no, you know, we need to really value our privacy unless they're going to say, or unless a company is going to say, yes, everything's going to be recorded. And if I'm fine with that, then that's a different deal. So.
And what's interesting, before we go off into some of the other topics Natalie has, because she's got so much stuff this week. I mean, it's a wonderful world of technology that we have. But we know we talked to Tim Rouse, who's the executive director of the Spark Institute, and talked about how there's an industry standard in the retirement industry that's been developed for cybersecurity. And my question, I guess a rhetorical question, that I'm not expecting anyone to call it on the phone now to answer it, is do we need some type of response or some type of guidance from the Department of Labor or the Securities and Exchange Commission? I would presume, you know, that these government entities, I mean, yes, these are financial and employee benefits organizations, but technology is everywhere. And, you know, we already have the Department of Labor weighing in on electronic transmissions as it relates to confirmation statements. So, you know, I think when do we get to the point where the federal government, the regulators kind of get in on the act, or the legislators on these things. So I think more to come on that.
If I could just chime in on that really quickly, I would certainly hope that these companies, that they have the opportunity to first lead the way and be the innovators, because they're the ones that are actually doing the work. So, and if that doesn't work, then of course oversight would be required. But I would like to think that the industry can put together a self-regulatory group of some kind to try to combat, which is exactly what's going on. So.
Yep. Agreed. So, Natalie, next week marks the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference that starts on Monday, and you're going to be attending. What are we going to be looking? What are we going to be hearing and seeing and learning about it on Monday, starting Monday?
Yes. So, this is the first of Apple's two big annual events. The first one is usually in June, and it's for developers. It's called the Worldwide Developers Conference. And their second one is in September, and that's when they unveil their iPhones and typically their Apple Watches. So this first one is usually focused on software. So we're going to be seeing new iPhone software, new Mac software, new watch software. And people are saying they're not expecting a lot of big updates with these softwares, but they are expecting Apple to give some special attention to ARKit, which is going to help people when they play AR games. And it was introduced last year, and it works on the iPhone X. And this year, people are expecting that two players will now be able to play an AR game against each other in the same virtual environment. So just little updates like that. Another
thing. Does that stand for augmented reality, Natalie? Is that what AR is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, of course, that's becoming big, and it's a big investment for Apple, and a lot of companies, you know, are trying to get in early on the big AR boom that's expected.
Nice.
And another update people are expecting is around health. And Apple has been talking about health for, you know, years now, and how they're really excited about the opportunities there. You know, the Apple Watch has become more and more health focused and become more like a fitness tracker over the years. And they bought Bedit last year, which is a sleep tracking company, and it's been doing things with that. So another cool update is that iPhones will be able to tell you how much time you're spending on your phone and how much time you're spending on each app to try to help people become less addicted to their phone. So it seems that Apple is listening to all the social commentary about how addictive we've become to these devices and how reliant we are on them. And they're kind of going about it by trying to become the good guys again and saying, okay, we care about your health too, and here are some ways we're going to help you improve that so you still feel good about using our devices. So that's something I'm excited about. I know there's some apps where you can pay to get access to a service that will tell you how much time you're spending on different apps, but this will be a free feature in your settings. So I'm pretty excited about that.
And that's exactly why I had the Apple iWatch. I actually have that. I'm currently at 71 beats per minute. And I burned about 400 calories today because I did work out this morning. So looking forward. Thank you. I need that. And then lastly, Nat, Netflix surpassed Disney as the most valuable media company.
Yes. Very exciting news. Netflix surpassed Disney and Comcast as the most valuable media company, which is really crazy when you think about it, because Netflix is just 11 years old and Disney is this huge legacy company, and it's not so great for Disney, especially at this time, because Disney is going to launch their own Netflix competitor in early 2019, where they will have their own platform with all of their Disney movies on it. It's going to be more family friendly, and Netflix just surpassed them, so not a great look for them, but it shows the power of getting into a market early. You know, Netflix knew back in 2007 that streaming videos online would be the way to watch TV and film, and, you know, in the next 10 years. And other media companies kind of overlooked that and kept focusing on, you know, feature films and cable TV and such. So it shows the value of that, and it shows the value of Netflix spending $8 billion a year on high-quality original content, and that's really paying off for them. And, of course, Netflix is in some debt. You know, they are spending a lot to keep their subscribers happy and to keep gaining new subscribers, but there's something to be said for being the most valuable media company right now. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, the first mover principle.
Yeah,
sorry,
I have this
George.
Visual in my mind of Mickey Mouse just clenching his fists right now.
Yeah, I mean it's I'll do a geek retirement analogy, George, and I think you'll get this more so than perhaps Natalie. You know, you look at target date funds. So target date funds represent what a large share of contributions in retirement plans, but there are what, three or four target date fund managers that have a high concentration of the assets, and that's because they were kind of first market movers.
Right.
And it's really hard to unwind that, I think. There's been some challenges. There's like over 50 flavors of target date funds, and I suspect that Disney will face some challenges, although I'm not a tech analyst, but it's less narrow than retirement. But yeah, Netflix is really creating content. I think Amazon and Netflix are kind of in this war of content. Who's going to be the content king? And you know, Netflix is clearly at the lead of spending and hiring these studio executives. So I guess more to come on that. I mean, we can't underestimate it. We've talked about this on the show with Todd Mason, the power of OTT, over-the-top networks, and the power of personalization. Mm-hmm. And what Natalie likes or George likes, I may find not as likable, and vice versa. So we all want our own content. So I guess more to come on this, but it's interesting to watch. And, you know, we just create our little content on our show. It's neat to see companies create hundreds of programs a year.
Yeah, what's our content budget, guys?
Zero. We're not. Yeah, that's a great lead-in for the end. So just for the end of the segment is that everyone here is really doing this because it's for educational purposes. We're not taking any money. We're not. There are no sponsorships, and really, we're all doing this to kind of share our knowledge with our peers and friends in the industry. So we have no budget, okay, is the bottom line. But you know, who knows? Maybe someone will see the value that's not affiliated with anybody in the investment or recruitment world. So I guess we'll see. So Natalie, enjoy your time off next week, and we'll look forward to your return.
Thank you.
And you can update us on the Worldwide Developers Conference and everything else going on in the tech world.
Thanks, Natalie.
Yes, look forward to it, guys. Thank you,
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
And of course, that was Natalie Walters. She's the tech reporter for The Motley Fool. And George, we've got a great guest coming up. We've got John Scott. He's the director of the Retirement Savings Project at Pew Charitable Trusts. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Jeffrey?
I'm doing fine. Long time, no talk. Last time I spoke to you, we were at the Spark Conference. We did a short interview. But it's great to talk to you. And I know you have a lot of really interesting factoids and really great information that you're covering and following at the Pew Charitable Trust. Do you want to start with state auto IRA plans? We've talked over the last couple of weeks with Lisa Messina, Carolyn McKinnon, and others about what's going on in that space. But how are you seeing it? What kind of work are you doing, and what are some interesting factoids you might have on that?
Yeah, well, you've been talking to some great people. You're obviously talking to the insiders. I think the perspective that we've tried to bring is understanding how small business owners and workers who would be covered by these state auto IRA plans would react to being enrolled in the program or participating in the program. And we've, in the past year, issued a few reports along those lines. And of course, we had some news yesterday that California is going to be part of a lawsuit from a local anti-tax group that questions its legality. And so I think our research may be relevant to that lawsuit as well. So just to sort of briefly recap what we've been doing on the research end, we did a survey of small business owners, ones without retirement plans. And then we did a parallel survey of workers at employers that didn't have a retirement plan. And we basically asked both groups whether or how they would react if a state auto IRA was implemented in their state. And just to very, you know, for the interest of time, I'll just sort of very generalize the results. In both cases, we found a strong support for the auto IRA concept. There were some reservations about the state sponsorship of an auto IRA plan. I think there's some skepticism out there about the government's ability to manage a retirement program, as you might expect. But in general, I think both with workers and small business owners, you know, they see a need for something to be done about retirement security in this country. So I think, you know, those sorts of results are pretty informative. And I think they're still relevant, especially with the lawsuit that was filed by the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association against the state of California yesterday. The Howard Jarvis Association makes two basic claims, as I understand it. One, that the CalSAVERS auto IRA plan is preempted by ERISA. And the second claim is that under state law, state government isn't allowed to engage in wasteful government spending. And so I think we have a couple of points to make there. And I should say at the outset that although I'm a recovering lawyer, I'm not a legal expert on these issues, so I don't want to speak to the legal merits of the claim. And I also want to say that Pew is neutral on state auto IRAs. We're neither endorsing them or opposing them. We're just trying to understand how the people affected might respond and whether it might make a difference in terms of retirement saving. But sort of one point about the lawsuit. So a lot of this revolves around guidance from the Department of Labor dating back to 1975, trying to determine whether payroll deduction IRA plans are employer-sponsored plans that would trigger coverage by ERISA, and which are sort of the model for these state auto IRA programs. A key criterion in that DOL guidance is that employee participation in these plans has to be completely mandatory. With last year's CRA action by Congress, it's now not clear whether automatic enrollment by the state meets this completely voluntary standard. So, in other words, does the nature of voluntary participation change when you go from an opt-in regime to an automatic enrollment regime with opt-out? So our survey of workers asked what participants would do, what was their intent at the beginning, and then we detailed each feature in the auto IRA program, and then asked them again about whether they would opt out or stay in the program. What we saw was that participation was very stable, even after a full explanation of the plan. 76% did not change their views after hearing all the details about the auto IRA plan. Of those that did change their minds, only 7% switched to opting out, while 11% shifted to don't know. So I think what this is saying is that, as an empirical matter, people are not being tricked or compelled. And as our focus group research showed, people are pretty accepting of the need to save and are fine with automatic enrollment, as long as the necessary communication and the opportunity to opt out takes place. And just the other point I would make about the California lawsuit is that there's also the claim that this is wasteful government spending. We do know from our research that upwards of 30 to 40 million Americans lack access to a retirement plan at their workplace, and that inadequate retirement savings could have very real negative fiscal effects for the state. And we did a webinar this past spring with a consulting firm in Philadelphia, eConsult Solutions. They had done a study for Pennsylvania that showed that the cost to the state of inadequate retirement savings would total about $14 billion over a 15-year period. So I think this idea of these state programs, which or at least are intended to be self-sustaining from the assets of the program, are wasteful. I think you have to look at sort of the fiscal effects of inadequate savings to take that claim into account.
And John, this study, that work you're doing, is it accessible on the Pew website?
Yes, it is. And I can send you the link.
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly reference that. I think we leave it up to the audience to obviously read it and synthesize it. I mean, there's so much going on in the space, and I think on this show we are constantly talking about coverage. George and I and the guests are always talking about ways that people can save and plan. We want to see people save and plan more. And so, it's interesting to kind of watch these things kind of wind their way through. But it looks like a lot of the states are really persevering. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch what happens in California as well, obviously, since that's our largest state. I know you had another interesting topic around modest account balances. What does your study say about that? What kind of work are you doing there?
Yeah, and this I think was an interesting study, and it was motivated by the state auto lottery plans, but I think it applied generally across retirement plans. And so really the question is, you know, what can you do with, you know, modest account balances, whether in a 401k or an auto IRA program? A lot of people suggest that, you know, people with moderate means are better off not saving, relying on Social Security and using their wages for, you know, current consumption. So we were thinking about this, and one idea we had was, well, how much would you need to accumulate to delay claiming of Social Security benefits, that is, using your account balance to live for a year or two and then claim Social Security benefits? This is important because, you know, every year of delayed claiming of Social Security, you know, gives you a 7 to 8% increase in your benefits. And that's a great return, whether you're talking about benefits or salary or investment. So we partnered with the Social Security Administration to do some modeling around this. They created a hypothetical auto IRA program and sort of projected it out outwards to the year 2040 to see how much people could save if they were in the program for approximately 30 years. And what they found was that about 40% of participants, if they had started in 2019 and continued for about 30 years, about 40% of participants would be able to delay Social Security benefits by at least a year. 20% would be able to delay benefits by at least 2 years or more. And the interesting thing about that, when you broke it out into, you know, the subgroups, was that we saw much a big effect for Latinos. I think it was about 44% of Latinos could delay claiming. And of course, people that are sort of higher paid or better educated. And what I think the dynamic there is, for people that typically are not covered by retirement plans and that would get picked up by an auto IRA plan, like Latinos, they're going to be in the program longer. So even if they're not making as much money, maybe not saving a lot, you know, because of the effect of time, they're going to accumulate enough of a balance to really have an impact on the ability to delay benefits. And then, of course, you have groups of people who maybe aren't in these programs as long. You know, they might change jobs and go to a job with a 401k plan, but because they make more money, they're also able to save enough through the auto IRA to delay claiming a benefit. So, you know, I think this is a sort of an interesting story that you don't have to save necessarily $500,000 or $1 million, but even modest amounts can have an effect on retirement security.
Absolutely. We will post the link to the site and to the study. And we'd love to have you come back on again, John. We're a bit out of time on this segment, but we'd love to have you come back in and talk more about these types of issues. Obviously, savings matters, and every little bit counts. So we appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we'll have you back in the next few weeks to opine some more on what's going on and how you guys, a few, are seeing it.
Thanks, John.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoy your weekend.
Welcome back. That was John Scott with the Pew Charitable Research talking about a lot of great research in regard to the state-run retirement programs. Joining us now, direct from D.C., David Levine, Kevin Walsh of the Groom Law Group. How are you guys?
Good. Good. Thanks for having us on. It's always fun to talk benefits on a Friday afternoon.
Yes. So what's top of mind this week?
Top of mind this week, you know, there's oh so much. We thought we'd go down a completely different road this week.
Perfect.
Cybersecurity, but we promise not to bore everyone. We thought we'd talk a little bit about what's been in the news, because we've all been getting the updated privacy policies in the mail for every website we use due to what's going on in Europe. And we thought we'd talk a little bit more broadly, though, just about the trends we're seeing with plan sponsors, service providers, and how all this works, and why bluntly you should care.
Yeah, I think one of the real trends in the past 5 years has been an awareness for plan fiduciaries, plan sponsors, and plan service providers that participant information can be valuable, and not only can it be valuable, but there are outside actors trying to get it. So the real trends we've been seeing are kind of an increased awareness of cybersecurity needs, and then more recently out of Europe, kind of a recognition that and ERISA has always had a recognition that information is valuable, but that individuals should have some rights over how their data is used.
And that, for the retirement world, opens lots and lots of doors. Like, to lay out a couple things that are out there, because everybody loves to talk cybersecurity, but let's talk about some reality in the retirement space. Privacy rights and data and cybersecurity, there's no one rule that governs any of that in the land of benefits. There's a couple pieces to keep in mind. First, there is the what about participant data and information? How do people use that? What can plan sponsors and fiduciaries do with it? What can service providers do with it? It gets into all the marketing and cross-marketing things that we all are out there. Then you get into the overlay of, well, what are good processes? What about data breaches? And that's a second area that we're seeing a lot of discussion on, because each service provider has a different policy, different approach. And to tie it all even into the Supreme Court last week, there's different rules because of that arbitration and everything like that, about what you can do if someone messes up with your data. And people don't always mess up, but there are going to be situations. And then third, the big one that really comes up is losses. That's the biggest one. We've all heard stories about many record keepers, and nobody is perfect here, and we're not here to throw stones in any one direction. But we've heard stories where someone has gotten into someone's account and drained the account. And what do you do then? And there's no perfect answers on all of this, but we thought those are three kind of big things to talk about this week. Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, just hitting on the losses item, you've got losses really two ways. One is the losses of, oh my gosh, David Levine broke in and drained my retirement account.
Thank you. I really enjoyed your money.
But you also have the issue of David Levine hacked the whole plan, and now he knows everybody's Social Security number. And that's when, I mean, I think we've all gotten those notices in the mail that we've got a free year of Experian monitoring. But if I could count up the number of free years of Experian monitoring I have just based on the last 12 months of mailings, I would need to live a long time to take advantage of that.
Don't worry. I've redirected all those notices to me now that I'm still in the super fine.
It's a comedy hour.
But that's the reality of it. So maybe what we thought we'd do for just briefly, because we know, of course, the podcast does not have unlimited time and day. Kevin, you want to talk maybe 30 seconds on GDPR and how people are thinking a little bit? Yeah. Very briefly.
Very briefly. This is kind of the elephant in the room right now. You have a tension where ERISA is essentially encouraging plan fiduciaries to gather as much information as they can, so that they can make sure that they can pay benefits they owe. On the other hand, Europe just has this massive new regulation that went online on May 25th. And it essentially says that you need to either have consent for each type of information you gather, and then whenever you use that data, or you need to have a valid reason for gathering and processing it. And the current thinking is that ERISA provides a good reason for doing that, but there's still a lot that needs to settle out. I mean, you had a Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, come in and say that it's unclear what anyone needs to do.
Exactly. And we don't mean to be the typical lawyers here, but uncertainty is the name of the game in this world. Then you go on to step two, the service provider discussion, where you have contracts. And how do you deal with cybersecurity? The SEC has raised this for advisors as well. And how do you track all these different pieces down? What are your contractual terms? There's the Spark data standards that are out there. Do you get a SOC report? Do you do an individual audit of your service providers? And here's the reality. If you're a plan sponsor or you're a counterparty as a business-to-business transaction in the benefits world, can you blame someone for telling you, I'm not going to tell you all my security measures because I don't want them to leak? So it's about developing, like everything else in ERISA, what is the right process to document you've done a prudent process to address the protection of participant data and information. There's no one right answer. And anybody who tells you that has a strong view, but it doesn't necessarily mean it is controlling at this point.
I mean, I think that's one of the really tough things with cybersecurity right now is you kind of have this back and forth between service providers where they're asking for a fair amount of disclosure on what's being done. But it's kind of like a map to breaking the code. So there's definitely some cat and mouse.
Exactly. And then maybe we'll turn to the last item. The last item is what happens when I take Kevin Walsh's account and take his identity. Because that's we make jokes about it, but unfortunately it is a serious matter.
it would be a lot more lucrative for me to take David's account.
No, no, no. Anybody listening to this podcast, Kevin Walsh is a better choice.
Nice.
But
oh, my Lord.
But the real take, the real point on this is it's important to understand what are the data guarantees you have here? What are the controls? Like, I can say my own account. I got a letter from our record, an email from our record keeper saying, by the way, we've shut down access to your account. Someone tried to access it. And I called them and they said someone might have punched in wrong numbers and we shut it down. Some people have RSA data security keys, sort of like the two-factor authentication like you do with text messages. Some people have voice prints. Some people have different things. And different vendors offer, and it's not just record keepers. Remember, your advisor could be part of this. Anybody else who has access to data, they all offer different guarantees, but how they work and how they don't work. The analogy I draw is where there was a lot of talk many years ago about fiduciary warranties, and they sometimes still exist. And there were different schools of thought about whether a fiduciary warranty from a service provider, what the value was pro con. And here it's important, no matter what role you have in the industry, to understand what those guarantees are, whether you're making them or receiving them, no matter what role you're in, to understand what it means and how you're making that work with your population. That's just kind of a brief takeaway. Anything else, Kevin?
I mean, I think that's a pretty high-level overview of kind of the key issues right now in cybersecurity.
Well, that is really well done, gentlemen, and right literally on the money. So thank you so much.
Thank you all, and don't mind that you saw a couple accounts opened in your name during this.
Take care, guys.
Bye, guys.
Have a good weekend. Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, that was a very interesting conversation with David Levine and Kevin Walsh on cybersecurity and all things in between data privacy. And now we're going to turn our attention to the pages of Plan Advisor and Plan Sponsor magazine. We're joined by John Manganiello. He is the deputy editor of those magazines at Strategic Insight. John, how are you today?
Very good. Thrilled to be here on the podcast. Jeff, it's always a nice perk when I find the newsletter you send out and see some of our coverage in there. It's always a nice, bump in the clicks, and it feels good to see, the folks are reading. So really, really thrilled to be here.
We're happy to obviously have you on, and we want to get your impression of what's going on in this week in retirement and benefits news. What is top of mind in your mind on the pages of Plan Advisor and Plan Sponsor magazine?
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting to hear the conversation with David Levine. He's been a great source for us and really top of mind for me this week, perhaps similar to what he told you. Really, retirement plan litigation continues to be such a common theme for us. We have a saying in the editorial room that if a week or even a few days go by where we're not reporting on either a new retirement plan lawsuit or a new decision in these cases, that we probably missed something, and it pushes us to go back and look and usually we did if we haven't been reporting on a new case in any given week or even over a few days. This week, a really interesting one that I wrote about was the 403B lawsuit targeting Northwestern University. This one was summarily pretty much dismissed by the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois' Eastern Division. I wanted to bring that up because this is one of, I think, five or six that we've reported on in the past year or two, filed specifically by the firm Schlichter, Bogart, and Denton, which I'm sure listeners are familiar with their work. With some variations, all of these suits, including the Northwestern University suit, they really call out 403B plan sponsors for high expenses, having an excessive amount of investment options, use of multiple record keepers, and together the allegation is that these things lead to duplicative, expensive, and record-keeping fees. Really, I thought this decision is important for readers to kind of look into because it pretty strongly rebukes a lot of the arguments that are kind of put forward in these 403B lawsuits. In this particular case, it seems like the judge really keyed into the fact that this law firm has, put forward a lot of these cases with very substantially similar allegations. It's almost a sort of a copy and paste type thing in some of the text of these lawsuits once you look into them. And it really seems like at least the judges in that circuit are starting to pick up on that fact, and they're a little skeptical about these 403B lawsuits. Really interestingly, though, this week, I believe it was just this week, maybe last week, the lawsuit against the 403B plan of New York University was allowed to proceed to trial. So it's just kind of a fascinating thing to look at. You know, in certain circuits, in certain venues, these 403B lawsuits are seeming to, you know, kind of fall flat. Alternatively, we have the NYU case this week really proceeding. I thought it would be interesting to point out to listeners that in that case, the NYU case, actually the advisory firm that works with that plan was carved out of the litigation. You know, they had been named as a defendant, and it seemed for at least a short time that they would be, you know, brought into court and asked to kind of participate in this lawsuit. But a number of months ago, they were sort of carved out. So it's just really interesting. And I think I would just also make the comment to readers that, you know, we continue to see a proliferation in the types of litigation that are going on out there. You know, at the beginning of my career reporting on these issues about 5 years ago, we were really hearing about things like ESOPs and, you know, employer stock drop suits. And it's since moved really into this idea of self-dealing with you know, retirement plan services providers, you know, seeding their own plans with their products. And there's really just a huge variety of litigation going on out there. That's something we continue to see. I'm sure it's something, you know, that David spoke at length about. You know, beyond that, something else. Yeah, please, Jeff.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I think we're in agreement. I mean, you know, this is the gift that keeps on giving if you're a you know, trying to defend against these lawsuits. And it's something that I think gets in the way, could potentially get in the way of tackling other challenges that are going on in our space that I know you're also covering in the pages of your magazine and on your website.
Yep. Yeah, no doubt. And I really think, you know, the takeaway for people listening is that it's really important to really dig into the decisions, and sometimes, like, the top line in the decision isn't really what's most important. It's really important to pay attention to how the appeals processes are playing out in a lot of these cases. You know, it was only a number of years ago that we saw Tibble versus Edison, one of the really famous cases. That made it all the way up to the Supreme Court because of, you know, this conflict between the circuits. So it's really important, I think, whenever you look at any specific decision or any specific case, to really think about the background of where it's taking place and potentially what could come next. So that's something I would really point to.
I'm curious, I should probably know this, but how does a suit like this actually come about? You mentioned a law firm, and it sounds like there's potential that they are approaching large employers and saying, hey, you might consider suing or whatever. So who is engaging the law firm, and also who then pays the attorneys?
Yeah, great question. It really varies. You know, that these cases can, most of them, I would venture to say, really, you know, it's not the participants themselves who are really pushing for these cases. These law firms, you know, I mentioned Slichter, Bogart, and Denton. There are a number of others across the country that have filed literally dozens of lawsuits. I haven't seen them myself, but I commonly hear from people, you know, out in different TV markets, literally seeing ads in the middle of the night or even in prime time, you know, asking about, do you know what your 401k record keeping fees are? You know, do you know exactly what you pay? You might be getting fleeced. There's really that sort of, it's an aggressive move by these law firms to really try to find plaintiffs, to really find friendly venues. So, you know, because I think you can probably imagine most participants in retirement plans don't wake up, you know, in the morning thinking about fees and really feeling like they're getting a bad deal. But most people, in fact, you know, don't understand what they're paying for their retirement plan, or they might even believe that it's free in a lot of cases. So I think it's I would say really that the plaintiffs' firms have taken, you know, charge here, and they're really out there aggressively searching for plaintiffs. In terms of who pays them, it turns out to be the participants, you know, or the plan sponsor, depending on exactly what happens. You know, we've had cases that have gone all the way to trial and have been settled that way, and it turns out that, you know, the attorneys will take their fee from the settlement, and it can be quite a sizable chunk of it, up to say a quarter of it, I've seen in some cases. You know, alternatively, if the employer decides it's not worth the risk of going all the way to the end of the trial, they'll often settle, and they're the ones stuck paying the bill. So really, really runs the gamut. But, you know, I would encourage, you know, any plan sponsors out there and advisors, you know, to understand that the plaintiffs' firms are really being aggressive, and they're out there searching for new targets all the time.
Thank you.
Oh, go ahead, John.
Maybe just to change gears a bit, because I know we don't have much time, and we could talk about retirement plan litigation for hours and hours. And in fact, at the upcoming plan sponsor national conference in mid-June, we've got, you know, panels upon panels dedicated to this topic. So, you know, would encourage folks to consider joining us there. I think it's going to be a valuable event. But, you know, beyond that topic this week, I've also been digging into the environmental social governance investing idea. I'm not sure if you guys saw the Department of Labor put out a field assistance bulletin fairly recently. It's a sort of an internal document aimed at helping its own staff police this area. But a lot of folks have read that document, and it really seems like the, as one might expect, that the new administration is taking a little bit more of a skeptical eye towards the role of ESG investing, you know, under ERISA. It's certainly something to follow. I see a lot of confusion out there about exactly what the field assistance bulletin means. Most people, you know, I had an interview with Northern Trust, say, and they're very active in this space, and they say that the field assistance bulletin, you know, really backs up their conviction about, you know, that it's okay to use ESG, whereas you have other folks who really are kind of pointing to certain specific lines in the field assistance bulletin that discourage plan sponsors from, quote, too readily considering ESG factors as they go about making investing decisions. So I'd encourage folks to read up on that. It's something that's kind of creating some confusion and uncertainty in the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, you know, something that requires a lot of due diligence and a process to evaluate not only that asset class, but all different types of asset classes. So I guess, you know, more to come there. John, we'd love to have you back again if you'd be up for it. Unfortunately, we're kind of up against time, but we'd love to have you
Absolutely.
And Plan Sponsor Magazine back perhaps next month to kind of bring us up to speed on what you guys are seeing as the top issues of the week.
Sounds great. Yeah, very good. The only other things we're tracking, TDF risks, open multiple employer plans. You know, we have a whole lot going on, so encourage folks to check out the website.
Absolutely.
What
Thanks,
is the website
John.
Again? I'm sorry.
Sure, plansponsor.com, all one word, and then planadvisor.com, spelled with an E, planadvisor.com.
Excellent. Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Right, thanks, guys. Talk soon.
Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You too.
Welcome back. That was John Manganiello from Plan Sponsor Magazine, filling us in on what's going on. A lot of interesting stuff. Joining us now is Jacob Passy, personal finance reporter from MarketWatch. How's it going, Jacob?
It's going well. How about you?
We are doing well as well. So fill us in on what's going on with jobs, sir.
Yeah, so the monthly jobs report came out. You know, ahead of the report coming out, there was a bit of a brouhaha because President Trump actually tweeted about it before it was released. And there's some talk that his tweet violated federal rules. And things like that. But basically, his tweet alluded to what was later seen in the report, that it was a strong month for jobs. Unemployment is now at an 18-year low. The economy added 223,000 jobs in May. So you know, we continue to see the economy, you know, kind of slowly moving towards full employment, which kind of is good news if you're you know, on the hunt for a job, because it means that you know, it's now a buyer's market rather than a seller's market. You know, the job seeker has a lot more leverage when there are fewer people looking for jobs out there and more people are employed. And there are definitely certain parts of the country where that is more true than others. I took a look this morning at which cities across the country have seen the biggest job growth over the past year, and kind of some interesting stuff in there. Midland, Texas, and Odessa, Texas, which are big cities for oil in Texas, they came out on top. Midland, Texas has seen 12% job growth over the past year, and Odessa has seen 6% job growth over the past year.
Wow.
So, you know, there's oil prices have been doing well. The American oil industry has been doing pretty well for the past few years. So, you know, that's definitely, you know, helping those local economies. And another interesting thing that I found was that a lot of tourism-based economies are doing really well. You know, more people have, as people's wages go up and things like that, you know, people have more discretionary income to spend on travel, and tourism revenues have been up, you know, around the country. So, so cities in, you know, Reno, in Nevada, cities on the coast in Florida, and New Jersey are seeing job growth as a result, because more people are coming to their towns on vacation and helping fuel those local economies.
Fantastic. I love it. Well, I know that we've obviously been talking about the retirement plan industry and privacy and lawsuits and any number of things, but fundamentally, the purpose of a retirement plan is to allow people to accumulate assets for their eventual retirement. But for a lot of people that aren't, what is that? Do you have a sense of what that's looking like these days?
Yeah, so Allie actually did a good story on this. So she came across someone on the website Quora, which is, you know, a website where you can go and ask questions, and they basically started this thread of, you know, try to think about someone who's never experienced a significant financial reversal, you know, before their retirement, and the person who posted it said they could think of no one. And you know, they kind of got a lot of responses from retirees who talked about, you know, having trouble making ends meet in retirement. So there was one person who had retired 15 years ago when he was 62, and he retired after, you know, building a small fortune by selling antiques and art, and also had equity in his home. But he can't get that equity out because he doesn't earn enough to make regular payments. And he, you know, is still selling stuff, but he said he kind of finds himself now at 76, and he's, you know, having trouble finding a job. I mean, he's basically, you know, he's gotten to the point where his reserves are so tapped that, you know, at 76, he's having to think about trying to take on a job. There were people who talked about, you know, having to rely on financial help from their children when they got into their retirement years and realized they didn't have enough saved. And that's, I mean, I think that's definitely a concern that's cropping up more and more, you know, the these days is, you know, pensions have gone by the wayside and people haven't saved enough. You know, they're relying on their children more. And so, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a continuation of a lot of the reporting Allie's been doing about, you know, just how difficult it is to save for retirement. But I think it, you know, I encourage everyone to take a look at her story, because I think it's, you know, a good look at, you know, we focus so much on the challenge of saving. We don't, you know, I feel like a lot of times we don't talk about what happens when you don't save enough. Mm. And so this was a good look at, you know, just a couple of anecdotes of people who didn't save enough and, you know, kind of what happened to them and how it's definitely, you know, when you want to retire, you know, you think of your retirement as a time to travel, spend time with family, things like that. But if you're, you know, if you're having this much trouble making ends meet for yourself, you know, it's hardly an enjoyable time of life.
I think that's a great point, Jacob, that we do spend a lot of time talking about how little people save, and it almost, it's like, yeah, I get it, it's almost like a throwaway, but when you actually do see real-world examples and real people that are in that situation that, if you're not careful, you too will find yourself in, it does frame it differently. So,
exactly.
Well, excellent. Well, we appreciate it, Jacob. You have fun things planned for the weekend?
Friend's birthday party on Sunday, but otherwise just taking it easy.
Perfect.
Taking it easy. Yeah. Well,
we appreciate your time and appreciate your insights as always, and we will talk to you soon.
Yeah, talk next week.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Welcome back to the show. That was Mr. Jacob Passy from MarketWatch giving us the lowdown on personal finance. And I'm very privileged now to welcome back to the show. It was off last week. Mr. Kevin Kelly from Bloomberg. Kevin, how are you, my friend?
Doing well, fellas. Like I said, love taping these on Fridays. In a great mood.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should also point out that our co-contributor, Oliver Rennick, is off today. So we're going to miss him. But we know Kevin can pick up the slack and give us the macro view of what is going on.
I'm actually going to be in Chicago next week, so I might swing by TD and see if we can do this next week live.
Well, that would
we'll
be
see.
Awesome.
It'll be in the works. We'll see.
That'd be cool. That'd be great. We could do like a live. Maybe we can do a crossover, like you know how they had like Different Strokes and The Facts of Life. Anyway, that's before your time, Kevin. Anyway, Kev, what's unless you've seen it on Nick at Night. So what's going on? We just had a jobs report. We talked to Jacobs about jobs report, but before we get into crypto, because we want to start the conversation this week about cryptocurrency, what's going on from a macro point of view in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, jobs report, like you said, you probably already covered it. But overall, I mean, pretty good report this morning. Got a bit of a tick up in the wage data, which, you know, we've been looking for to kind of, I guess, reassure some of these inflation expectations recently. But overall, I mean, the market was pretty benign up until today. We've seen a pretty big bump today. You know, in the S&P 500 here, the U.S. equity market, and the market's kind of just muddled through. And so the interesting takeaways from this week, you now have tech stocks that are jumping to back above all-time highs, breaking above those March highs, which we've been looking for, you know, kind of as a key indicator for us, because tech stocks at this point are such a, you know, large part of the index and U.S. equities in general, about 25% of the S&P 500. So that's a big thing we're watching. Small caps continue to make new highs. I talked a little bit about that last week in terms of, you know, the expectations for earnings are starting to increase and come back a bit for that group. But a big thing is the dollar just continues to keep making highs, and it's something that, you know, I'm sure you guys are almost sick of hearing at this point. And I know Oliver's been a big proponent of this for a couple months now, but that's something that, you know, we continue to watch for, especially as it relates to Europe. And the difference, the divergence, I guess you could say, between the two regions. Dollar surge, as I mentioned, continues to go higher. A lot of that is because the economic data, this idea at the beginning of the year was that the dollar would pretty much remain relatively flat, decline. I think the expectations were something like 1% overall for the dollar to decline. And you've seen kind of the opposite of that. And a lot of that's because the economic data story has shifted a bit, where you have you know, economic data coming out for the U.S. that's a bit better than Europe. The surprises are a bit better than Europe. So you've seen that rally in the dollar versus the euro. And historically, that's been the economic data has been a bit of a leading indicator for this, too. So to say that the dollar rally is going to get cut short just because of the rise it's had so far, you know, we don't necessarily buy into that. Long term, I think the dollar definitely has some structural weakness. But, you know, you could continue to see the dollar push a bit higher here. How that affects, you know, the everyday consumer. One of the big ways is oil prices. We've seen, you know, a little bit of a pullback here in the last couple of weeks for oil. But in general, when you're going to the pump, you know, gas prices obviously heavily influenced by, you know, general oil prices, and a stronger dollar historically has meant lower oil prices. So that's one thing that, you know, if you're, you know, the retail investor, you could definitely be watching for. But overall, you know, market after today, we'll see where we stand, but could end up being a pretty good week for stocks.
Nice. Love it. So you did a presentation this week, a webinar of some kind on crypto?
A webinar, yes, sir. We had Mike Novogratz, who is the CEO of Galaxy. His firm actually partnered with Bloomberg to launch this new Bloomberg crypto index. So any Bloomberg users out there, there is a crypto index that's available on Terminal now. But yeah, it was a webinar this week.
Tell us a little bit about it.
So basically what we went over, and this is a really interesting space, and I'm excited to get, you know, Oliver's take and get Oliver on, because we'll have some cordial debates over where this market's going to go. But it is really interesting. I mean, this whole concept of cryptocurrencies in general, and, you know, I won't be the guy who comes on and says, you know, we're going to the moon or all these other kind of sayings that people have, or all this jargon that gets thrown around. But the concept behind them is, undoubtedly interesting. And you're starting to see a separation in what the traditional cryptocurrency or what people think of cryptocurrencies are, and then these kind of offshoots or deviations from the original cryptocurrency model, to the point where, you know, I kind of break them down into multiple, you could say sectors, if you're looking at it again from a stock perspective, different sectors of cryptocurrencies or crypto assets. So this week's webinar was really focused on Mike Novogratz, who, you know, has his ear to the ground for the from the institutional client space, which is really where you're going to see a lot of this big money, or maybe the next like hire for the crypto market, come from. A lot of institutions haven't been able to get into crypto, one, because it's extremely volatile, two, because there's just a lack of understanding and there's a lack of research in the space. So it is pretty ad hoc in terms of, you know, trying to figure out what exactly even the space looks like. And three, the biggest one, at least in my opinion, is the custody issues, where the way in which, you know, you even buy cryptocurrencies and you store them and you trade with them is completely different, or in large part different than traditional asset markets. And so until you see a few of those bigger kind of issues solved, I don't necessarily think we're going to see a huge influx of institutional money. But what Mike is, and Mike's kind of known as a bull on the street, you could say, in the crypto space, he is very convinced that this idea of the herd is coming, which is referring to institutional money, could push, you know, cryptos, you know, to new highs.
Love it. So you referenced this the Bloomberg Crypto Index. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, for sure. So it's essentially what we try to create is like this, what we call an adult supervised version of tracking the crypto market in general. And so it's heavily weighted towards, you know, the top cryptos that most people have heard of at this point, Bitcoin obviously being the most notorious, but things like Ethereum is right up there, Litecoin, different cryptos of that nature. But basically what, you know, you're trying to do here is there's no way for an institution, again, going back to that concept, there's no way for an institution to get in this market and essentially capture beta, right, or just capture what a market return is, because there aren't indexes out there. It's such a new and such an immature market right now. So the whole concept behind this was, you know, kind of putting you get the Bloomberg name behind a crypto index, which not only adds credibility to the space, but at the same time tries to kind of wade through and say, here's a way in which you can gauge the market moving forward, which reduces some of the volatility. Again, hopefully the long-term vision for it is that it eventually becomes some type of, you know, benchmark for institutional players. And that's where, you know, the partnership with Galaxy and Mike Novogratz talking about it this week, that's kind of where this comes in as a key benchmark for people moving forward.
Got it. So everything you were just talking about, how institutions have sort of having a hard time getting their arms around it, how far off are we from being able to buy a crypto index like the S&P 500? I can go and buy a Vanguard or buy a S&P index ETF or mutual fund. How far off is that from a crypto?
Yeah, so it's tough to nail down an exact timeline, I would say. It's certainly something a lot of people are watching for. One of the big catalysts, again, for this market will be when you get some type of product like an ETF, right, where I can just go on. I can log on. I'll use TD as a plug, but I can log on to my TD Ameritrade account and actually go purchase this. One of the big things that we're watching is the SEC and just regulation around this space. Again, since it's so new and people don't necessarily understand the economics behind it, what some of these even are, it's tough for a regulator to come out and kind of rubber stamp it or put their stamp of approval on products that track it or invest in it until they get a better understanding of exactly what it does. So timeline-wise, people have thrown around, I mean, I believe Novogratz this week, he said 3 to 6 months he expects to see some of these products come to fruition.
That quick.
Which was surprising to me too. It's very soon, but most people I've talked to, it's more so in the 12 to 18 month range before you really see some Main Street adoption, because to your point, you get these investment vehicles like an ETF or even a fund that, you know, the average person would be able to invest in.
Yeah. And I would point out that, like we were talking about before you joined, Kevin, on ESG, we're talking with John Manganiello. You know, it's an asset. It's kind of a newer asset class, a newer segment. It requires a lot of due diligence, a lot, which means unwrapping the product, understanding the investment process. I mean, that is really appropriate, especially with retirement plans like defined contribution and defined benefit plans. Even if they were going to consider going down the road of cryptocurrencies or real estate or any other non-traditional asset class. So I think it's kind of a long road.
No, 100%. And I think, again, similar to the ESG argument, you know, when it comes to like alternative investments, you have that alternative investment slice of the portfolio, right? It's easy to see how, again, maybe it's not in 3 to 6 months, but 3 to 5 years from now, a part of that sliver gets cut into cryptocurrencies because they are uncorrelated with other assets, right? So if you're, again, a pension fund manager or anybody who's in the institutional side of things, or even somebody who just wants to diversify their portfolio, you know, you could actually have access to an asset class that is very uncorrelated to traditional markets like equities or fixed income, and has the potential, again, if you take a more active approach, has the potential to, you know, give you some pretty serious gains along the way. So I think it's emerging. It's still very immature, and I'm excited that you guys are starting to venture down this rabbit hole, because, you know, each and every week, you know me, I could talk for hours about it. So yeah, I mean, anybody who's curious about it, feel free to reach out, you know, if you have listeners or whatever, but yeah, it's exciting. It's an exciting time.
Absolutely. Awesome. And you're going to be in Chicago next week. I saw that you're going to be speaking at an event in Chicago, which I'm assuming you is why you're traveling there.
Yes, I will be speaking at the Future of Investing event, sponsored. It's a Bloomberg event, but it's sponsored by good old PowerShares. So I'll be at the Art Institute of Chicago next Thursday night.
Great.
We still have some free spaces too. So if anyone's interested, let me know.
And go check it out.
Absolutely.
Love it.
Well, yep. Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Thanks, fellas.
All right.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Well, there it is, Jeff.
There it is. George, another great week. Wow, we covered so many things. I was trying kind of taking notes because we've got to do the description. There's a lot of different topics we cover, from cybersecurity to, you know, the state retirement plans to litigation. I mean, it kind of ran the gamut, but it was a great week of education. Underscore the word education, no advice, right? Just education here that we're trying to illuminate.
Yeah, lots of really smart folks sharing a lot of great information. So grateful for all the contributors, and good talking to you as always, Jeff.
Always a pleasure to talk to you as well, and looking forward to connecting again next week, and we can bring the some more great guests. I know we have some great guests lined up, and continue the great conversation that we've been having for the last few months.
All right, man. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks. Bye.